Hi, it's the All in the Mind podcast. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, the ancient memory code used by Indigenous cultures around the world.
I was blessed with an extremely bad memory, and as I was looking into the way Aboriginal cultures know their animals and plants and environment, I start to ask, how on earth can they remember so much stuff? You're talking 1,000 plants, 1,000 animals when you're including the invertebrates. I couldn't work out how they could possibly know this.
Lynne Kelly is a science writer from Monash University who's immersed herself in the methods used by ancient cultures to retain vast amounts of information about the country. The traditional Australian Aboriginal memory technique is embedded in their dreaming and song lines.
I'm Karen Adams and I'm an Associate Professor in the Faculty of Medicine, Nursing and Health Science at Monash University, and my cultural background is I'm Wiradjuri and I also have Irish heritage. Indigenous Australians have been here at least for 40,000 years, so we are the longest continuing culture in the world, and part of that is about our dreaming or our song lines, and different Aboriginal people would have different interpretations of this, so I think it's quite important to say that what I'm talking about is my understanding of that component of our culture. And those song lines and dreamings are often held in physical parts of the country, and that assists us to maintain our continuing culture. So stories are handed down in families that relate to country, and often those stories are about social law, they can be about creation stories, and they can be contemporary stories as well. It's quite complex, but those land markers are very, very important, and hence the importance of land claims and acknowledgement of traditional owners.
Wiradjuri woman Karen Adams.
I have the 242 countries of the world and the independent protectorates all memorised in population order. So, for example, I've got Brazil linked to a window in my study. At that window, there is an entire group of colourful dancers dancing all the time in my imagination. I always know Brazil is number 5.
Lynne Kelly set out to discover more about an ancient memory code in Indigenous countries around the world, and she picked up some impressive memory techniques along the way. More about her own songline later. Lynne Kelly collaborated with Australian Indigenous people to gain an insight into their encyclopedic memory, which is an oral tradition and deeply connected to the landscape.
The colleagues I've worked with, in particular Nungarai, who's Wulpuri, she described their knowledge as absolutely intense and pragmatic. As she pointed out, they wouldn't have survived if they didn't have all this practical knowledge and handed down generation after generation. And so I worked with Aboriginal organisations and the recommendations they had on which researchers to read.
So tell us about what you've learnt about the concept of song lines.
Songlines are known as navigational tracks in that the elders or the trained Indigenous people will sing the landscape and therefore be able to move from location to location through it and teach each other. But that's just the very beginning. At every location, each sacred site within that sung track, they perform rituals. Those rituals are repeated songs, and those songs encode the information. So some research has shown that up to 70% of the songs are knowledge about animals, plants, seasonality, all the sorts of information you need to survive and know that environment backwards.
So when you say they sing the landscape, what exactly do you mean by that?
They have songs that sing from location to location, and descriptions like, we will sing the messmate here, we will sing the rock wallaby there. And so they're singing the information in songs that tell stories, because song, story, mythology is so much more memorable than a list of facts. So by describing a plant and giving it characteristic and behaviour, you're actually making the information much more memorable.
Lynn Kelly. Karen Adams has rich childhood memories associated with the land.
My very early memories of being on country are the names of towns in Gippsland. For instance, Turidan, and its name means basically a swamp monster. And Kooyrup, another little tiny town in Gippsland, means place of plenty blackfish or baskets of blackfish. And in fact, going back to those country towns and knowing what those names mean creates a much deeper connection to place, because you start to think about, okay, this is a swamp and there's mangroves and the swamp stagnant mud that has a very distinct smell. And I think knowing that history and knowing that there, you know, have been artefacts found in Turidan that are 30,000 years old, that there's a very old, old history in that country and a story in that country. And I think that's something that all Australians should take a great deal of pride in, that because of Aboriginal culture, we have these continuing stories to our country that other countries actually don't have. And I think that that's something to be really proud about.
Karen Adams. Lynn Kelly describes an Indigenous song and dance ritual used in hunting, sometimes called hunting magic.
Magic is a term that Westerners have used because we don't have the right words for what they're doing. So before a group of hunters will go out, they will perform rituals, repeated acts. So if they're hunting kangaroos, for example, the dancers will demonstrate the way the ears move if they've detected movement, something else, how they will scratch if they're relaxed. That sort of information is hugely helpful to get close enough in order to hunt a kangaroo, but also the tactics. You don't want one hunter calling out to another guy, hey, Joe, go left, because your kangaroo's gone by then. So they will dance the tactics, they will dance the behaviour of the animal and so on, so that they can keep in touch with each other and improve the hunt. So when they talk about hunting magic improving the success of the hunt, it really does. They will also call on supernatural actions, but I can't analyse that because I'm not Indigenous.
So what is your understanding about the actual mechanism that helps with memory when you're relating it to landscape?
The song lines link positions in landscape. So each location in the landscape acts as a mnemonic, a memory aid to a particular part of the information system. So the knowledge is literally grounded in the landscape, but it'll also be supported by portable devices, different forms of art, some like the Aboriginal Tjuringa that are highly restricted, some like message sticks that are less so. So information is encoded to a range of devices. Using these devices and the landscape and song and dance and story and mythology, that combination is an extraordinarily powerful memory technique that reinforces itself. There's evidence coming out of knowledge of landscape changes dating back 7,000 years, if not longer. The mechanisms are so robust that those things like formation of islands around the coast of Australia after the Ice Age and sea level rises and so on, are accurately recorded in oral tradition and now being shown to be so by scientists working with the elders.
In her book, The Memory Code, Lynn Kelly explored the memory techniques of traditional Indigenous cultures around the world. For example, she visited the Chaco Canyon and studied the Pueblo culture.
Chaco Canyon in New Mexico was built about 1,000 years ago, which is massive buildings. Pueblo Bonito, the biggest, is up to over 600 rooms, some circular, some square, around plazas, up to four stories high, aligned on solstices, the whole lot, built there by the ancestors of contemporary Pueblo people, who then after drought moved up to Mesa Verde and now down to the Rio Grande. Cultures change, they're dynamic, but you've got a continuum there. And again, you get exactly the same traits, but this is with a settled farming culture, of using the landscape as a memory aid, using portable handheld device, using mythology and characters. In their case, their characters are called the Kachina. So you've got the same technologies, and that's what they are. These are memory technologies, and we could gain so much from learning them. You've got the same technologies because it's to do with the way the human brain works, and they are the most powerful way, which is why all modern memory champions still use these techniques today.
Yes, you say that this system fits in with the way the human brain works. What do you mean by that?
Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2014 showed that the human brain associates memories with place. So people will remember things that happened at particular places much better. So this association of physical place with memories is naturally the way the brain works. And by using sequences of places, so a sequence through the landscape, you have absolutely grounded it in order so that you can't lose any of them. And that's why the song lines sequence things, or the handheld device keep a sequence. So the ancient Greek orators from Homer right through Cicero, Augustine and so on, and they wrote down the way these methods were used. And it's exactly the same again, that they would place each part of an oration, a great long speeches, in a position in a building. And then when they were giving the speech, they would imagine themselves moving through that building or through the streetscape. So our Aboriginal people don't need to be walking the song line to call it. It's so strong in their memory as well.
It's something that I've noticed if I'm listening to a podcast and I'm going for a walk, and I'll often remember bits of what I've heard on the podcast and then think of that bit of landscape that I've just walked through.
Now, if you do that deliberately, it is unbelievably effective. So it just becomes, with initiation or higher levels of learning, a more and more vivid memory space.
You're with the All in the Mind podcast. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today, an insight into the intricate memory techniques used by Indigenous cultures. Lynn Kelly, author of The Memory Code, has studied the way memory is embedded in landscape in many cultures. Drawing on these techniques, she's developed her own memory code, or songline, to remember swathes of information she was not otherwise able to do. As with many oral cultures, she's used the environment around her.
Well, I started with the countries of the world. So I started in my studio, my office where I work, and in each location around that office, the first 10, I've put the top 10 countries of the world, starting China, India, United States. Then I go out, right around the garden, right around the house, down the street, pick up the bread and come back, and by the house not far from home, I'm down to Pitcairn Islands with 66 population. Each house in each location represents a country. So now if I'm watching the news and a country comes up, like Réunion, when they found the plane crash parts, my brain automatically goes to that position. It doesn't have to go in sequence because it's fixed in sequence by the landscape, and I can add that bit of information. And it just grows and grows because there is a structure. So I've done all of prehistory and history. I start 4,000 million years ago, walk around prehistory. It takes about a kilometre to do that, right round history up back to today on a portable device, sort of like the Aboriginal Turinga, but modelled more on the African Luba, Western African Lakasa. I've encoded a complete field guide to the 408 birds of Victoria. Now, I was blessed with a terrible memory, and now I can memorise all this stuff, but it's so much fun and so vivid.
So what's the process of the associations that you make with what you're trying to remember and the bit of the landscape?
I'll just create stories. On the birds one, I've got one particular shell glued on my bit of wall, which is for Laridae, for the terns and gulls and so on.
So just to clarify, the portable device that you're talking about now is like a stick that you've glued particular objects onto.
Yeah, it's a piece of wood that just fits neatly in my hand, and I've glued about 100 shells and beads and things on fairly randomly. I didn't do it deliberately, but I've now encoded the 82 families that we have in Victoria, one to each of those beads or shells, and then I add to that the extra information. And I do it through story. So if I want to encode the Pacific gull and the kelp gull, now these two are very similar, larger gulls than the seagull that you see down the beach. And the difference is in identification that the Pacific gull has a bit of a red tip on its beak while the kelp gull doesn't. Otherwise, they look almost identical. So in my head, they're the Pacific gull, who is always drunk, that's why his nose is red, and the kelp gull, who is a health fanatic. They're brothers because that's the code I use, that they're the same genus, and they're arguing the whole time. The kelp gull telling the Pacific gull that he should stop drinking, the Pacific gull telling the kelp gull that his life's boring. So when I'm down the beach and see the birds, I look for the identity. But when I'm playing with these characters in my mind, because they're now part of my life, they become more human-like. So they morph in their concept to me depending on what aspect of them I'm talking about. And that comes across in Indigenous stories all the time.
So is this why stories and mythologies in Indigenous cultures are often exaggerated and fantastical?
Absolutely. It makes it more memorable. It's just much more fun.
So how do you make memory markers about things that you don't know anything about?
Then you have to use puns, and Indigenous cultures do use puns. There's so much humour and vulgarity and everything else that makes us human in those stories. So if you don't know anything, so Comoros is a country I knew nothing about. It's a shop that happens to be across the road from where I normally walk. So it's come across, and therefore when I look there, I think come across, get round to Comoros and add all the rest of the information there. So I use anything. Reunion, I imagine a reunion with a French teacher because it's a French dependency. So every time I walk past that shop that represents the French protectorate Reunion, I imagine that I'm meeting her.
So how sustainable or robust are these memories that you've associated with particular places?
Those that are easy, that come up easily, you put in once, it takes about a minute and they're there for good. Others don't work as well and take a bit longer and you have to repeat them a few times. But you do need to repeat them probably once a year or so. But the song cycles, Indigenous cultures have ceremonial cycles where they repeat the information and therefore ensuring that it's remembered. But it also gets adapted. So new information is added. So our Yolngu people up north added all the information about the Makassans from Indonesia and also about colonisers and so on. That gets added. Things that are less valued get dropped out. Oral tradition is dynamic.
And do you think using this method strengthens your memory generally for everyday things, even if you don't use the memory code per se?
I've started to use it naturally, so absolutely. Because I've now got hooks for every country, every place, every time I can walk through time. Not every event's in there yet, of course, but I've got hooks for everything, and that's what's so powerful.
Do you feel that your head is just getting too full?
No, and that's what's really weird. It somehow doesn't. It's very hard to explain because what's happening in your head is completely different to anything I had experienced before. So it's images and actions, not words. If I go right around my countries, I'm not actually saying the names. I'm just getting images at each place. And I'll pull out the words if I want them. It's really hard to explain. And I think that's why early ethnographers immediately said we must teach literacy and civilize these poor folk without ever asking, should we learn orality, O-R-A-L-I-T-Y? Orality is what people have when they don't have literacy, and it's also incredibly powerful. I would love to see schools teaching the combination of the two.
Lynn Kelly.
A lot of the ceremonies and rituals and continuing stories, they reinforce belonging and social connection and strength of identity and who you are, so your confidence and how you travel in the world. And that has an enormous impact on mental health. In neuroscience, they talk about all these sort of things a lot as being indicators of well-being. So those connections to country, those social connections, the rituals, the ceremonies, the stories are really, really important for people's well-being.
Karen Adams is Associate Professor in Medicine and Health Science at Monash University. They've developed a program in the country town of Mildura. It reinforces the deep memory of culture and connection to the land for the local Indigenous people.
The program's called Welcome Baby to Country, and it's a continuing cultural practice of welcoming babies to country through traditional owner groups. And that practice has changed over time, but the fundamental components of that remain. So it is about elders and babies. It's about welcoming children to country and the importance of children being connected to country. So the landmarker of the river in Mildura, the Murray River, is a tribal, part of a tribal boundary and a part of a song line, and very important to people in Mildura. And Welcome Baby to Country reconnects children to that story from very, very early age. Sometimes they're a week old. And in a contemporary way, it happens in Mildura. It happens at the Mildura Arts Centre. It's a very formalised ceremony. And the traditional owners of the local area, the Latchi Latchi people, are on stage. And the babies come up and they are formally welcomed by the elders to the local country, and their families are all there watching, and the whole community's there watching. And it's a witnessing of that child's connection to that country. That child was born on that country and lives on that country and is acknowledged by the traditional owners as being on that country. So the stories are contained in the land and in the people.
Karen Adams is from Wiradjuri country, but she now lives in Melbourne. How are her cultural memories maintained?
I would say that things that have been reinforced to me through imagery and story and continued exposure to something like, so in, I'm not from, my family and cultural background isn't from the Melbourne area, but because I've grown up here and lived here for a long time, I've seen countless stories and images of Bunjil, which is the creation spirit for the Melbourne area. And I think for any Aboriginal person in Melbourne would see reinforced time and time again through Aboriginal organisations, logos, artworks that people are creating, they will see the image of Bunjil. And I quite often drive from Melbourne to Geelong, and there's always wedge-tailed eagles flying over that area, and that's Bunjil. And I think, oh, there's Bunjil. And, you know, Bunjil turns up at a lot of events, like funerals, a whole bunch of events that Corey's go to. We are always looking in the sky for Bunjil. So wedge-tailed eagles are part of the country, and every time we see them, it reinforces that story.
Wiradjuri woman Karen Adams. Here, she shares a story from her childhood, which she's remembered vividly throughout her life.
So Wiradjuri essentially means three rivers. So immediately we associate ourselves with being river people. And there's one really beautiful story about a duck and a water rat. There's different variations of the story. Sometimes it's told that the water rat took the duck, stole the duck. In other variations, it's that the water rat and the duck fell in love. What happens is the duck becomes pregnant and has some babies, and the duck is too embarrassed to show the babies to her duck family because they're a mixture of water rat and duck. So the family ostracises the duck, and she takes her babies down the river and leaves a baby in different places along the river. And those babies are platypus, basically. And I think it's a social law story. It's about appropriate marriage. It's a story about relationships, but it's also a relationship to those animals. So every time I see those animals, I think of that story, and also to the river. So, you know, I think about that story every time I see any river, actually. So that story is undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands and been handed down through thousands of generations. So, you know, it's such a simple story, but it's quite profound as well.
So bearing that in mind about what we've talked about, that absolute connection and association you make with your surrounding environment, what are the implications for this when the landscape is changed or disrupted or destroyed?
One thing I would say is where those places can be cared for and respected, that's very important. But obviously landscapes are often altered, sometimes through human intervention, but also through nature. And I'd say that having a continuing culture that's lasted for at least 40,000 years, Aboriginal people have had to adapt. We have had to adapt our landscapes. So I think stories get altered or new stories get made about the new landscape. So one, we're very adaptable, but two, I think landscapes do need to be respected and cared for as well.
Karen Adams. The importance of caring for country is certainly something Lynn Kelly agrees with after her research into the memory codes of Indigenous cultures around the world.
Absolutely. If you sing the landscape and your knowledge is embedded in it, that's your encyclopedia, and somebody puts a fence across it and stops you, that's equivalent to knocking down a university. But it's so much more than that. Even with my small experiments by comparison in using the landscape in this way, I've become unbelievably emotionally attached to my landscape. How much more intense must that be for people who are inheriting their prior generation's knowledge and brought up with this invigorated landscape that's alive with characters? I had no concept of the depth of knowledge, the absolutely critical nature of the songs and stories, and in particular the landscape, and the bonds between people. I just had no idea. And the thought now of what the colonisers did to Indigenous people is just horrendous.
I'm dancing with my spirit.
Lynn Kelly, author of The Memory Code, which is published by Allen and Unwin.
I am dancing with my spirit.
Head to the All in the Mind site for more information from today, and there you'll find a link to the ABC's programming during this NAIDOC week. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Marty Peralta. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Bye for now.
Yeah. Life's mystery. Now we're